The Guardian. Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark.
It is this party that is for the many, not the few. Yes, the land of despair was Labour, but the land of hope is Tory.
At the Conservative Party conference in Manchester, David Cameron takes his aim at Ed Miliband. The Prime Minister says the government's still clearing up Labour's mess, but did he actually offer anything new? Earn or learn. That was his message to the under-25s as the Tories ramped up their rhetoric against the unemployed. Meanwhile, the Daily Mail goes to war with Ed Miliband. But has the episode backfired on the paper that's famously in tune with Middle Britain? Plus, the government in the United States has shut down over a budget dispute. What does it really mean in practice? Could the biggest economy in the world really be on the verge of a spectacular default? All of that to come, and joining me this week, we have The Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee, our economics editor Larry Elliott, and down the line, with another conference season under his belt, The Guardian's political sage and scholar, Michael White. And welcome to you all.
There are still over a million young people not in education, employment, or training. And today it's still possible to leave school, to sign on, find a flat, start claiming housing benefit, and opt for a life on benefits. Isn't it time for bold action here? We should ask, as we write our next manifesto, if that option should really exist at all. Instead, we should give young people a clear and positive choice. Go to school, go to a college, do an apprenticeship, get a job. But just choose the dole. We've got to offer them something better than that. Think about it. With your own children, would you dream of just leaving them to their own devices, not getting a job, not training, nothing? No. You'd nag and push and guide and do anything to get them on their way, and so must we.
Government as pushy parent, then. Before David Cameron arrived in Manchester this week, he was handed a challenge by Ed Miliband to show people that he understood the pressure of the cost of living as it was felt by most people in the country. And then to show whose side he was on. His party's response was a get tough message for the out of work. Polly, so what came out, I'm not sure it was quite in the speech, but certainly in the briefing and the subsequent press report, was there'll be no more dole or any other benefits for people under 25. Is that a big change? What could it be done?
It's an awful lot of spin, because after all, the idea that anybody doesn't have to do anything for their dole, the screw was tightened quite a lot by Labour, great deal more by this government. You have to obey whatever your job centre person tells you to do, whether it's going on the work programme, which has failed mostly, huge numbers of people coming out of it still without a job. But you really have to turn up and do stuff and obey them. We had that lawsuit of the young graduate who was sent to Poundland and didn't like it and objected. Well, I suppose the idea is that every graduate or person coming out of, a further education college with any number of qualifications will be sent to Poundland. How that's supposed to help them get their foot on the ladder, get a job, I don't know. An awful lot of parents will say, hang on, this means my kids have to stay at home until they're 25. And some of those, of course, will have had the bedroom tax imposed, because when your kids leave for college, you then have to move out of your home. So there'll be kids sleeping on sofas, I presume.
The sofa generation. Mike, I guess as with many of these things, there's a lot of detail still to be worked through. A broader brush level. David Cameron talked an awful lot, and an awful lot more than he normally would, I thought, about Ed Miliband.
Yeah, that was interesting. When you say detailed who worked through, you've got to say or not worked through, because even listening to Polly's summary, which may not be the most detached anyone will hear, you realise how the bits don't fit together. You know, we've got to address youth unemployment. It's both economically inefficient and it's a tragedy, and it upsets you even to think of 1 million NEETs not doing any of those things. But the solutions have to be made to work. Right, broad brush, Ed Miliband. Yeah, the strategy was clearly to go after Ed. And not to go after UKIP or Nigel Farage, not to call them loonies or fruitcakes. And more interesting to me, not barely to give the Lib Dems a clip round the ear. Now, Cameron would have been well within his rights after what Vince Cable did, that sort of hugely enjoyable but completely have your cake and eat it assault upon wicked Tory capitalism at the Lib Dem conference, to have really put old Vince through the Moulinex. But he didn't. He ignored him. It was just as I remember, just one clip where he said, you know, don't tell us about cutting taxes, Lib Dems. It would be like us telling you to, and I can't remember what
constitutional
the punchline. That's right. Pointless constitutional reform. I knew I'd forgotten it. I didn't want to upset Polly. But that was it. And it was all 25, I think I read, 25 references one way or another attacking Miliband. So clearly he rattled them a bit in that speech last week. And I read in some of my papers this morning that, you know, Cameron too is going back to what he calls 70s-style socialism because he's trying to control bank fees, season ticket costs. And
but there wasn't much of that in the speech, was there?
No. What they do is sort of the speech is broad brush. I thought not a bad speech, you know, cheerful optimism, no details, no difficulty. He doesn't challenge his own party. I thought it was sort of Blairish in tone, except Blair took an opportunity to take on his own side and some sort of, you know, it's rather like taking the dangerous corners out of a railway. You've got to address structural problems in your own side, and Blair used to do that quite well, and there wasn't any of that in
Cameron. But, Mike, one of the things really missing was any sense of I feel your pain.
You can't do that, can you?
Out there. Well, he could have acknowledged a great deal more about what a lot of middle Britons feel about the way their pay is falling far below inflation. They're really finding it hard. And I thought it was interesting that he didn't try to own the cost of living question. Now, afterwards, he's briefing, telling the Times front page and all sorts of the amazing things he's going to do.
But they do it afterwards. It's a bit like the budget briefing in a funny way. All the interesting bits come off screen.
But, Larry, I thought that the strongest bit in the speech by far was when he was able to sort of say, you know, people said we'd never recover if we stuck to our plan, but retail sales, construction, investment, and the list went on up. No one's been gloomier than you during the long crisis since 2008, but is he right? Are we now into sunlit uplands?
We're not into the sunny uplands. I think that 2014 will be a pretty good year for the economy. Going to have 5 years of zero interest rates and large amounts of borrowing and huge amounts of quantitative easing, you're bound to get some sort of response. I think the critics of austerity economics, of which I was one, never said for a moment that the economy would never recover. Economies do actually recover from even the deepest of recessions. Our point was it would have recovered much more quickly had it not been for the damn fool economic policies that this government imposed. And that's the point. It's not really the question of whether the economy recovers or not, because all capitalist economies grow at a certain rate. You know, normally about 2-3% a year. So at some point we were going to get back to that. The fact is we wasted 2-3 years getting back to it because the government cratered the economy.
So we'll get back at some point. You think it's plausible to think it might be 2014. The crucial question then that drops out of the conference speeches is whether people will really feel it. Do you think it will be there in the wage packet?
I think 2014 is going to be a better year for people's living standards because inflation is going to come down a bit, probably below 2%. And as the economy grows, people will be able to probably get slightly higher wage increases. So the two lines will cross and therefore people's real incomes will start to grow. The big question in politics is which of the two narratives, competing narratives, do people believe? On the one hand, it's the conservative narrative. We inherited a huge mess from Labour. It took longer than we thought to clear up the mess because it was so enormous. But now things are getting better. Therefore, don't hand the economy back to the people who wrecked it in the first place. Or the alternative one, which is that this is a recovery for the few rather than the many. Most people's living standards have fallen. And it's the question, are you better off than you were 5 years ago? To which the answer, even after a strong year in 2014, will be no. People in 2015 will probably be worse off than they were in 2010. Big question, do you think Labour would do any better if they were put in charge? So that's the...
So it could go either way, it sounds like you were saying.
I agree with most of Larry's economics there, except that I think there was much less room for Labour to manoeuvre in the difficult circumstances we found ourselves in 2010. We weren't like the Greeks. Cameron raised the Greek bogey, completely phony again yesterday. We weren't like the Greeks, but we were in a hole, and Labour hadn't leaned against the boom. Osborne said they should have built up a surplus. They should have leaned against the boom. It's the political consequences which trouble me. Which narrative will they believe? I don't see any evidence, notwithstanding all the pain that Polly spoke of, people are suffering, that they won't go for the masochistic narrative, which says we had to do this, it's all Labour's fault, or mostly. Cameron didn't mention the bankers either yesterday, not once, and that Labour will only screw it up again. We know that's not quite what happened, but it will hold better than the more we can do it.
There is another narrative, the forward narrative. As we know, elections are won on the offer for the future, a bit on the past, but not really, I mean, except insofar as credibility is concerned. So what Osborne said in his speech was 10 years in the freezer, that's it. And when you look ahead at the Institute for Fiscal Studies projection for the first 2 years, and now he's added in, another 2 years after that, it looks appalling quite how deep the cuts are still going to be, and they will be real cuts. They can say that it's a spending freeze, but it amounts to being a big cut. Well, my guess, and I don't know whether you agree with this, Mike, is that the NHS will be in very bad trouble in 15 months' time. It is bursting out all over already, and I don't know that they are going to be able to give it enough bungs to stop it really being in quite serious trouble by the time we get to the election. And I think that the idea that there's going to be even tougher spending ahead is going to be quite a hard sell.
Well, of course, the government has borrowed much more than it intended to, and the Office of Budget Responsibility projected budget deficit for 2017-18 is still $42 billion. So in a way, they've been forced to be more expansionary than they...
But most of that's gone on the price of failure. Most of it's gone on sort of unemployment pay and things they've had to pay due to having grown.
It's because of low growth. I mean, the fact is that if the economy had grown at the rate that they expected it to in 2010, then by now the budget deficit would be down to $60 billion. That was the original plan. It's actually $120 billion. So Osborne has actually been a bit more flexible than people give him credit.
He had no choice.
Well, he could have tightened into the downturn. He could have actually tried to stick to his original plans, which would have led to even slower growth. Osborne is a bit more pragmatic than that. He wasn't going to actually have the economy nosediving straight back into recession by even more severe cuts.
The big thing they've got up their sleeves is tax cuts. There was a little taste of that in David Cameron's speech, wasn't it? Like, don't make any mistake, we're going to keep cutting taxes.
They can't do it, though.
Well, can they, Larry? Do you think that...
Daily Mail's gone big on it today. Great page of, tax cuts for the future.
It's hard to see how you can square tax cuts in the run-up to the election with the idea that you're going to have two more years at least of austerity straight afterwards, unless you're going to actually cut even deeper into departmental spending or welfare. I mean, it's hard to see how they square that particular circle.
They can't do it because Polly's quite right. Where they're really vulnerable, because the voters do blame them not Labour, is on the NHS, which is, as we all know, the religion of the British people. And the narrative works entirely against them because of the Lansley Act. No, nothing's
because
ever entire.
Because after all, what we saw both from Cameron and from Hunt, the Health Secretary, was a real attempt to switch the blame and to say, look at mid-staffs, that happened under on Labour's watch. And we're trying to repair an NHS, filthy hospitals, all the rest of it. Any anecdote of anybody who's ever had bad treatment.
But that's not true. Most hospitals are fine and most treatments are fine. I was in an acute ward last weekend. We know those stories are fundamentally, they're real, but they're not the majority of stories, and people know that.
We'll come back to health, I'm sure, many times before the election. But on the conferences in general, there's plenty more on our website at guardian.com/politics. But the other thing that's been bumbling along in the background this week, while the Tories were billeted at Manchester, has been an old-fashioned hatchet job in the Daily Mail directed against a man who's been dead for 20 years, Ed Miliband's late father. The prominent Marxist was labelled the man who hated Britain in an article on Saturday, which was subsequently more or less reprinted in full. Polly, there's widespread resentment, isn't there, across lots of bits of the political spectrum at the tone of this. But from their point of view, I suppose, Ralph Miliband had a very definite view. It's not their view, and it's fair game.
Yes, it's been interesting who's come out to defend Ralph Miliband. Lord Moore, John Moore, as was a Thatcher minister, has come out, passionately defended him, said he was taught by him at LSE, and the very idea that this man hated Britain or was some kind of disloyal fifth columnist, absolutely not so. And you've had Heseltine coming out too. Well, you have to remember, the Daily Mail makes enormous numbers of enemies amongst most politicians. Those politicians no longer in positions of power can afford to say rough things. Interesting that both Cameron and Hague sort of sidestepped it and didn't dare condemn the Mail. But those who are now out of office can say what they really think. And most politicians detest the Daily Mail, even though they're terrified of it.
Mike, is that your reading as well?
Well, to make a conversation like this work, you really got to have somebody sort of putting up the opposite point of view a bit. There seems to me two problems with this. One is that the accusations against Miliband Sr. are actually he's not guilty of. That is to say, he defended Stalinism and the camps and all the rest of it. He went all the way. He was a theoretical Marxist, perfectly respectable position to take on all sorts of things. But he's not guilty in the way you might say Eric Hobsbawm, who got rather too good a send-off from The Guardian, in my opinion, when he died this year or last year. Not guilty in the way that you could say Hobsbawm was and Miliband, and that's why John Moore defended him as his teacher at the LSE, courteous, decent man who respected a different point of view. He tried to reconcile socialism with democracy. It's one of the great challenges of the 20th century, never reconciled. So one, he's not guilty, but other people were, and anybody old enough to remember the Cold War, old enough to have read the books of the 1940s and the evasions of the left in the 1930s, which in their way were as bad as the Mail proprietor Lord Rothermere defending and sucking up to Hitler and Mussolini. You know, these are deeply held feelings, so acknowledge that. Last point, which is really tricky for us, is that when Margaret Thatcher died, some terrible things were done. They were, of course, whipped up and exaggerated by the Mail, which is dead. Remember all that stuff. And the right is saying, well, hang on a second. Well, did you people on the left say, you shouldn't really be saying this about Margaret Thatcher? You know, it's not appropriate at this time. And, you know, some people did. I probably have a vague idea I might have done myself just to be awkward. But, you know, these are not, it's not all, it's never quite black and white.
This is different, though, because this is about trying to smear Ed Miliband. They don't give a damn about Ralph Miliband, probably barely knew who he was.
That's right.
This is about politics now. It's about smearing Ed Miliband with
so
the idea
so
that his
Damien
father
McBride,
was.
Damien McBride, of course, whose book came out last week. You know, yes. This is not, there's never black and white, I'm afraid.
But Larry, isn't there just a basic point that Mail's always been associated with family values, and on the family values count, you know, you want a son who's going to stick up for his father. Isn't that why they've got this one wrong?
I think they have got it wrong. I think that, you know, up until now, the one thing that the ordinary member of the public thought about Ed Miliband was that he shafted his brother.
Yeah.
And now it actually has actually given him definition, has enabled him to actually get off that particular hook by being the man who stuck up for his father. So,
yeah.
So the Mail, it seems to me, is absolutely classic own goal.
I mean, would it be nice if we had David Miliband perhaps throwing in a bit too here?
Well, perhaps, but I mean, right. I think that, you know, if you'd asked people up until now that their abiding thought about Ed Miliband, it would be that he deprived his brother of the job. It was a Cain and Abel show. At least this time, you know, Ed has actually got the right sort of definition, which is that he's, you know,
well, he does this. He has bursts of it. He knows the Mail's going to come after him and his entourage. Quite a lot of emphasis on the second half of that, by the way, between now and election a day. And therefore, he's trying to set. There was a cold calculation as well as an act of filial emotional response, my dad. He had to say, what am I going to do with this? You know, they're going to come after me anyway. Let's set it up in my terms. Remember what these people did to my father. So there's a bit of political calculation in that too. What struck me as intriguing was that senior politicians, now active, David Cameron, William Hague, slightly failed the courage test here, because here was a chance for them to go beyond what they did say, which was, a man should defend his father. We understand that. Like Cameron said, my old dad, I think of him every week. Good stuff. But here was a case for going further. And Tony Blair failed this taste. When he made his feral beast speech, Blair attacked the independent, the weakest link in the chain, rather than go after the Mail and Alistair Campbell. And he, I think, had a row about that at the time. And Campbell said, you know, if you're going to make an attack on an individual newspaper, it's got to be the Mail. And Blair wouldn't do it because they're all scared of it.
So, Polly, if this has changed the, you know, the previously not too flattering kind of public caricature of Ed Miliband a bit. The other thing we've had in the last few weeks is Syria, where he had that big call to make. Do you think he comes out of conference season looking much more assured in his position, or not necessarily?
I think it's interesting that he's come out as the most interesting person. He's come out as a person who set the agenda. That's what the Tories were all talking about, what they were thinking about. Whether it ultimately benefits him, we still don't know. He has certainly come out as a champion against big, strong forces, against cartels of big business of the kind who don't pay their taxes here, multinationals who are unaccountable, cartels of energy companies, against Murdoch and now against the Mail, on Syria, very much on the side of the people against us going to yet another futile war. I don't think it's quite gelled yet into a distinct sense that he's immensely strong. Mm. But I think the week has been pushed away a bit for the time being.
By red, though.
red, which is quite dangerous, because what you got the day after he made his speech at the conference, you got the entire row of Tory press saying the lights are going to go out, red, terrible socialism, back to the 70s. I can't, you know, the idea that he hadn't exactly said nationalise anything, or he hadn't said anything that was really, anybody could regard as very socialist. But it gave you a flavour of quite how ferocious the hit back is going to be.
It's quite hard for them, for the Conservatives, to make that charge there. I mean, the argument that Ed is, you know, interfering in the energy market, yeah, fair enough. But actually, the government is going to interfere to keep down train fares. The government is interfering massively in the mortgage market. So the idea that there's some sort of Ed is, you know, disobeying the rules of economics here by meddling the market just doesn't wash politically, because the government has also got his fingers deep into the economy to manipulate it.
It should do. That's the function of government. And the Republicans in Washington, when they were more literate than they are now, known that since Theodore Roosevelt 100 years ago or more.
Well, let's leave Britain there for now, because Mike Rage is a subject which is normally reserved for dystopian novels and futuristic disaster movies. What happens if you wake up one morning and find that there is no government? This week, after budget negotiations broke down in Congress, citizens in the United States had their chance to find out. Hundreds of thousands of government workers were told to stay at home and to turn off their BlackBerries. So what does it all mean? I asked The Guardian's political columnist in Chicago, Gary Young.
Immediately, it doesn't make a huge difference. You know, the Panda Cam is off at the Washington Zoo. You can't visit the Lincoln Memorial or the National Parks. A range of other somewhat minor inconveniences. If you had a tax refund coming, you wouldn't get it. If you want a passport, I need a passport for my newborn child, well, then they're not working, visas aren't being issued. So if you happen to be one of those people, a small number of people who has planned a wedding at a national park, who needs a visa, who needs a passport immediately, then you're in a lot of trouble. But for most of the other things, they can mostly keep them going for a couple of weeks or so. After that, things like possibly people in airports and slightly more serious things. If you're immigrant services, immigration courts, some of the courts will stop functioning. So for the first couple of weeks, it will be, for the first week or so, it will be a story about inconvenient tourists and those individuals who happen to be caught in the snare. It doesn't mean that anything, it's not like a major collapse of institutions, but as time goes on, it could.
And there's, you know, we're used to these bouts of brinkmanship now over all fiscal matters, aren't we? We've had so many of them, debt ceilings and sequesters and, you know, terms that we're all getting used to over here now. Can you see this thing ever getting back on? Can you see the United States government getting back onto a stable footing anytime soon?
It's difficult to see how, and here's why. An awful lot of these gridlocks stem from the fact that the constituencies, the congressional districts, are heavily gerrymandered. And so of the 18 or so hardcore Tea Party Republicans who are really holding the line on this and therefore holding the, both the Republican Party and the government hostage, most of them were elected, I think two-thirds of them were elected, with more than 60% majorities in heavily gerrymandered districts. And so the scope, the impetus of compromise, which would come from irate voters, isn't quite there in the way that it would have been. And even if they weren't gerrymandered, and the gerrymandering really is the main thing, the political electorate, the electorate is so heavily polarized and increasingly polarized that what this gridlock does is reflect a major bifurcation in the American polity.
So that's Gary Young's there. View. Mike, you've spent time in Washington. Is it a different game now?
Yeah, it's much more polarized. That's partly because, believe it or not, American state governments are allowed to draw up their own boundary lines. And they gerrymandering, it's an American word, Mr. Jerry, in Boston 100 years ago or more. And therefore, they can kind of fix it. So they get entrenched. Hardly any seats changed hands. The middle ground is pushed apart. This is just a symptom of it. But it's more significant than that. Right-wing, know-nothing populism represented by the Tea Party is wagging the dog of the Republican Party. John Boehner, the man who's, you know, standing up to the president, is doing it because he's got, I was going to say a pistol, but it's more likely to be a hillbilly shotgun in his back, and has to do it. It's disastrous, but it feeds into Berlusconi in Italy, into the rise of right-wing populism. You know, the most extreme form is these arrests of Golden Dawn in Greece. I'm overdoing it here, but you know what I mean. And that has a sort of very mild impact on how David Cameron and George Osborne have to speak this week. They don't talk about UKIP and UKIP's simplistic populism, but it comes round to the circle which is exposed very dramatically in Washington this week.
Larry, you've got the bizarre spectacle today of the President of the United States saying Wall Street should be panicking about American debt. But doesn't this feel like one of those dramas that is going to blow over? The American government's not going to default on its debt, is it?
Well, everybody imagines that will be the case. But I can, you know, and if it's solved this week, then the impact on the American economy will be relatively minor. There won't be particularly long-lasting effects, apart from maybe the Federal Reserve will be a bit more stimulative for a bit longer than it otherwise would have been. But if these people really are as crazy as they appear to be, then it could well be that this will go right down to October the 17th, which is the deadline for raising the debt ceiling. And the closer it gets to that ceiling, to that deadline, the more damage there's going to be. And the markets have been relatively well behaved so far, but you can imagine that this time next week, as the days start to tick away towards October the 17th, you know, get down below 10 days and people start ticking off the dates on their calendar, then there could be quite a violent market reaction, particularly if it seems like there is going to be no give. I mean, I don't actually see why, what's in it for Obama to give anything. I don't see why he'll surrender to the blackmail. It's up to the Republicans whether they actually want to blink first.
And they let the Lehman's go down, the Republican Bush administration in 2008, one of the greatest miscalculations of the post-war
period. We shouldn't imagine just because sensible people would say that this can't happen, then it can't happen. It could happen. And if it did happen, if the Americans did default on their debts, have a technical default, then this would have serious ramifications, not just for the American economy, but clearly for the global economy and for the government's chances of actually getting a pre-election boomlet going here. I mean, there are big stakes here.
Polly, have you any thoughts on why it is that what seems to have come out of the crisis is more right-wing than left-wing populism? It's not what you'd have expected, is it, after a crisis that started with the banks?
Very strange, but it also happened, you know, in the 20s, early 30s. It's always fear against optimism, and fear is what plays to the right. Optimism tends to come in slightly better times, and the left does better. And it's a very hard truth that you can have the prime example of the most dysfunctional form of capitalism, and it ends up apparently benefiting the right in most places.
Greatest soundbite of the 20th century from its greatest democratic politician. This nation has nothing to fear but fear itself. Franklin D. Roosevelt, inaugural speech, 1933.
Well, at least we rescued ourselves from what was going to be a fearful close otherwise. So my thanks to Mike for that, and also to Polly and Larry for taking part. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.